RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Friday morning means our political panel here on RCR. And this morning on the panel, Jan Rivers of Genspect, back on RCR in a different role as a political commentator this morning. Jan, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, no problem. Good to have you. Natalie Cutler, Welsh. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Paul, and hello, everybody.
And Rodney Hyde. Gosh, Rodney, it seemed like only yesterday I was talking with you.
I know. We're going to have to stop meeting like this, Paul.
I want to go back in the hot tub.
I bet you do.
Can we do that?
You naughty man.
Well, it's the conversation.
Oh.
Yeah, and it feels good. All right, great to have you on our panel this morning, you three. I want to start with this. Let's get straight into it. And that is the whole question of Cook Strait ferries. Jan, you have, some insight into this?
The only little, I do have a bit of insight, actually. Back at the, I think 2019, I was working for the Transport Agency, working on part of their information policy. So I wasn't an engineer or anything, just a librarian, but they need librarians. And I was fortunate to be invited along to the annual transport conference, and I saw the presentation by the people who were talking about the new ferry. And I love public infrastructure and good quality public infrastructure. So my ears were burning and I was very excited to hear what they were planning, which was basically what's just been cancelled. This was 2019. Mm-hmm. So the quotations, the initial quotes had been made in 2018 for a cost of something like 750,000. It ballooned out in the end.
Million, wasn't it? Million?
2.5 billion. And yeah. I thought this is really interesting because I catch the Cook Strait ferry reasonably frequently. I go over to the South Island. And when I hear that the ferry has lost power in the middle of the channel, or it's a ferry has grounded on the sides of the sounds, or there's been another incident where it's bashed up against the harbour wall and has knocked a hole in it, I get a bit worried. I've never had an incident on the ferry. All of my journeys have been fine, but hundreds of people have been, out at sea in big seas with no power, and they have. Cargo ships have been grounded. So I was very excited to hear about this and that we would have some new ferries rather than ones that are at the end of their life. It worries me a lot that we might be one incident away from another wahine when we hear about the kinds of things that are happening. And the head of Main Freight was being interviewed on national radio, and he was bemoaning the fact of the cancellation of the ferry contract and its replacement with something which won't include rail. And it struck me as somewhat ironic that the head of Main Freight, who runs loads of trucks around the country, would be so exercised by that. And it struck me that there's a real issue there. If the head of the biggest logistics company is telling the government that they're heading in the wrong direction. So that's my very brief take.
Okay. I think they use rail a lot, Main Freight. It's part of their network. And I think the Arimawana was delivered in 1962 with rail capacity, roll-on, roll-off rail, which seemed completely obvious, right? I mean, why would you ever want to move away from that? Anyone want to say something about that?
It seems to me that in every country that has rail, it's a hugely important part of the national infrastructure. It's a hugely valuable part. And the danger that we have at the moment is that we have a government of a stripe that has in the past sold the rail company off to private interests. And you only have to read a little bit about Faye Richwhite to realise what happened there, which was a national disgrace. People enriched at the massively to the detriment of the public sphere.
Okay. Rodney, you'd have a view. The cost of these ferries, these new ferries, they were just like over the top, weren't they? And it seemed like just amateur hour putting that together.
The whole thing seems a disaster. What we knew with the previous government was that they were useless, and they never had an eye to the bottom line. And so clearly we got into a bad contract. However, what we know about the present government is they aren't actually too sharp either. And I think they've acted in haste to cancel that contract, worried about the ballooning costs, without actually thinking through, as Jan says, our infrastructure needs. And it all looks to me like very bad political decision-making on both sides of the House. And the losers of this is the New Zealand economy and the New Zealand public, because we actually do need a decent ferry across there. And we've got to appreciate that's a rough bit of water. You know, that's world-class rough water.
Yeah, but we've been dealing with it for decades. I used to watch the old ferries go out into all sorts of seas. Now, if it's over a certain metre of the swell, they stay in the harbour like scaredy cats. So, you know.
I agree with that too. I agree with that. But, of course, you've actually got to have the kit. And it's not cheap getting good kit these days. And I think this present government acted in haste without actually knowing what their backup plan was. Clearly.
Natalie, anything to say on ferries?
Well, my only thing would be, back in the day, I used to do some sailing out in the Marlborough Sounds there, working at Outward Bound. And you definitely, we relied on the ferries to bring the students to us and back and forth and get them home again. So I think we definitely want to have some reliable transport. I agree with what you're saying, Paul, about the roll-on, roll-off with the rail facility capability, because otherwise I think you're double handling and it confuses the logistics. So something that is reliable and very seaworthy, definitely is, I think, really important.
Yeah. It always amazes me that we've always been able to do it in the past really well. And all of a sudden now.
As long as it's not an electric boat, I'm good.
Yeah. Might short circuit if the water gets in. Yeah. Was that part of the cost blowout? Were they to be electric, the new ones, or something? Jan, did you know about that?
I think they were pretty traditional boats, and they were going to be completely new, built in South Korea, and were going to be costing 600 and something million, which was a little bit less than the initial quote. But I did a bit of research, and about 3% of the value of our GDP, about $14 billion a year, gets transported across the Cook Strait ferry. And even at the cost of $2.5 billion, it was only twice the cost of Transmission Gully. And we're talking about, you know, really big infrastructure. We're talking about earthquake-protected port harbour capability at either side. So it's not a trivial piece of engineering. And the other thing is that the initial costs came in within months of the Labour government being elected in 2018, which makes me wonder whether they didn't perhaps rush to something and maybe not give sufficient consideration to actually what the cost might be. But the final thing that I wanted to say is that it appears that Labour had pretty much pulled the plug on this even before the election. They were not coming up with the funding. And there's a lot of the this has only come out in May, June this year, when the papers associated with this topic became part of the public domain. A number of papers were released. And so they left the new incoming government with, in some ways, a very easy, if slightly more impactful than they hoped for, decision to make.
All right. Apparently it's better to be without power out in the wide open sea than coming into the harbour. You're in more danger coming into the harbour, and that's, of course, what happened to the Wahine. When you're out there, you just bob around, you know.
Yes, the mistake of the Wahine was to come in, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And and that's where it ended up, on the rocks there. All right, let's move along. This week we have talked euthanasia. Simon O'Connor was on the program, and he's been on Q&A. Of course, Todd Stevenson, ACT Party member, has his member's bill to expand the assisted dying law. And we got a lot of feedback on that. And most of it was kind of against, which maybe is intuitive for our audience. I don't know. I've got doubts about it. So, Rodney, do you want to talk about this?
Oh, yes, please. Well, I've completely flipped. I used to be in favour of euthanasia. I had a dear friend who died, who committed suicide himself. He had motor neurone disease. He'd watched his mother die of it, like choking on a tongue. He didn't want months and years of that suffering. And so he took his own life early. But he had said to me that if we had euthanasia laws, he would have hung on and he could have lived another 10 years. So I was very much a proponent. But of course, back then, I was naive and young, and I trusted in the authorities and government.
Right, there's that, yeah.
That's long gone. And now we have the situation where the ACT Party, along with our parliament, have introduced laws that in certain prescribed situations, you can agree to be killed by a doctor or someone who will administer the death to you. And now Todd Stevens has come along as an ACT MP to sort of loosen those criteria. But it strikes me that I'm dead against it now. I think it's heinous to expect other people to assist in killing you. But following the logic, if you want to kill yourself, I'm not making this case, but what I'm saying is if you're in favor of euthanasia and someone wants to die and they need help, who are we to say that you can't have that help once you allow it to occur? This is the old slippery slope argument. It seems to me there's no philosophical reason why anyone who's wanting to be killed can't be euthanized, given our current situation politically. And we're going to see now a constant relaxation of the prescriptions because they don't have a logic. Like, what is the logic of saying, well, oh, you don't meet this criteria, so you can't be killed?
So anyone who wants to be put to sleep.
Well, that seems to me, I mean, that's the argument that you're the owner of your own body, right? They don't believe in God, clearly. And they're saying if you're uncomfortable at this stage, it's in pain, but you can be in all sorts of pain. The fact that you want to kill yourself means that you're a very unhappy person. What logic do they have to say that it should be denied a person? You follow my point?
When you
can't kill anyone, you know, end of story. That's my position now. But given that we're having this argument about loosening it, it occurs to me that actually, why should there be any prescription on it following the proponents of this legislation's logic?
There'd be plenty of people lining up for the job. You know how humans are. Natalie.
Well, I'm originally from Canada, and so I'm wary of the rules that they have at the moment. But I hear what you're saying, Rodney. I mean, I've never been in such bad physical or mental pain, and I've been in a lot of physical pain, let me say. I haven't really been in much mental pain, but I've never been in that position where I, you know, would even contemplate it. So it's hard to say because I know there's a lot of people who have been in that spot. However, I am wary of the potential for peer pressure. I'm wary of it not being that person's, right? The sovereignty issue. I'm worried about it not being that person's decision. It's the family who's going to inherit money, or it's the doctor. You know, in Canada, I'm pretty sure they strongly encourage people who even have depression, teenagers, to sign away the euthanasia. It's crazy out there. I think it's a minefield.
Crazy.
It's a Wild West, and I'm not for it.
Jan, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm very vexed about this issue because for myself, I think if my life becomes intolerable through pain or a difficult diagnosis, I would want it for myself. And that's as a sort of relatively privileged person, I guess. I do see also the danger of peer pressure or external pressure that could be applied to people who are vulnerable. And I also think that the information coming from Canada and the Netherlands about the proportion of people who are choosing to have a euthanasia is, to me, was quite shocking. You know, like something like 20% of the deaths. I'm not absolutely certain of the details, but a significant number. And I realized then that we're moving into a different era with how to die and who might choose to die. And it feels like for all the conversation about the new law coming in, we haven't really had that conversation. And it may be that it's one that we just need to have. But obviously the slippery slope argument and the danger of the lack of control and pressure being applied to people are big concerns for me.
I'm thinking about things like, how do we pay superannuation in the future? What's a good solution to that? Kind of persuade people to take one for the team like they were persuaded to do during COVID, you know? I mean, is there anything in that, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there will be kids coming up and they come up and mum's not well and she's rallied and says, I've got to get back to Australia for work. And they'll say, mum, why don't you just pop off now and we can deal with everything? Or
we get the house.
It's costing a lot of money. And very subtly, you know, you're lying there on your deathbed and your little brat son or daughter is saying to you, have you thought about this option, mum? I think it's disgusting.
And what about the morality of it? Here's what I've thought about this particularly recently, and I, like you, Rodney, was kind of easy on it a while ago, and I've known a few people who've died, you know, that may have qualified for that in my lifetime. But isn't there a responsibility in life to face the hard things? Isn't that where life really means something? I know it sounds a bit roundabout or upside down, but, you know, if I'm faced with choking on my tongue, okay, that's not very nice, but I'll handle it.
That's the God question. That's the God question, Paul, where as a recently minted Christian, I realize that it's God who chooses when we die, and he doesn't give us challenges that we can't actually handle. And they're a test. And you meet them. And you don't run away. And you certainly can't look a doctor in the eye and say, oh, doctor, kill me.
Most people choose the doctor, and there are only about 160 in the country that'll do it. So that's, everyone's in the hands of a very small group.
Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying, Rodney, and I come from more of the universe perspective, and I do believe that we are here to learn and grow, and we are each served up a slightly different lesson or multiple lessons, but we're all here for different reasons, I think. And I also love to look at the emotional meaning of a physical injury or ailment. So with that being said, I think, yeah, we can persevere through things, but again, I'm not sitting here in mental anguish or pain, so it's a bit of a biased opinion.
Jan, get your thoughts on this mental anguish and pain.
Yes.
I'm thinking of the chats that we've had about transgenderism. There's going to be a lot of people in all sorts of mental pain out of this, isn't there?
Yeah.
There are examples.
A tsunami.
There are examples, I think, in Belgium and in Canada of people who have they have come to regret their transition, asking for assisted dying, which is, of course, utterly heartbreaking.
It's tragedy on top of tragedy.
The mental situation of people who come to regret is, even without that consideration, is extremely dire. But what was I going to say about the mental anguish? I guess I've a bit like Rodney. I've been a lifelong, well, I don't know, I've been a lifelong atheist, and I have come, as I've grown older, to have a more nuanced and spiritual take on the world. And I just think these are very sort of vexed questions, and we need to keep talking about them. And I know what I was going to say is that my experience with friends and relatives who have been in close to death experiences and through the hospital system, i.e., they've had a severe stroke, or they had, like, for example, my mother had a lot of memory loss, and at one point, my sister and I and my two brothers were asked how we wanted her care to go forward. And we decided as a family, without really my mother being able to be involved, that palliative care would be preferable. And it seemed to me that we did that with an amount of love and concern for her well-being and the very, very low quality of life that she had. So I guess these are sort of difficult, complex questions, and they will be different for different families, and there will be people who are beautifully cared for, and there will be people who are basically not wanted any longer, and we need laws and conversations that allow a diverse lot of different situations to be handled in the best way possible.
It's the creep that we've got to be careful of, isn't it? The creep of it.
Yeah.
I think that's right, yes.
Just on the creep, I think this is why principles are important. Because I think if we look back over the last 30 or 40 years, you can make a very subtle change and you've lost the principle. And once you've lost the principle, you can't argue it. And that's how I feel about euthanasia. Once you say, yes, you can choose to die and then get someone to assist you in it, not suicide by your own hand, get someone to assist you, then you've lost the principle. And I think if we look across so much of what is wrong with New Zealand society at the moment, including the trans issue, it's because we lost the principle long ago.
Yeah, and if you can encourage someone to mutilate themselves and do those things to themselves, then you can encourage them to do other things.
If there's a doctor prepared to castrate you, then, you know, they can kill you. And, of course, we shouldn't forget that the very first kids that had reassignment surgery under Dr. John Money's care, both the twins suicided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
That's a very pertinent point. I mean, I guess one of the things that I think is sort of the obverse of that argument about principle is the adoption of postmodern thinking, which brings in its wake a great deal of relativism and a great deal of a kind of separating us from some of the wisdom that comes from our culture, whatever culture that is. And in particular in mind, you know, the sort of problems that were solved 2,000 and 2,500 years ago by Greek philosophy, they're still really pertinent now as the basis of some of our thinking. And I've only become aware of that as an adult. It's not something that came with me from my childhood. I kind of had echoes of that understanding of the world, if you like, but not the actual principles. And I think there would be much more really high quality principled thinking. I've been looking a little bit at some of the thinking around people who were writing about Marx and Freud in the Second World War, and it seems to me that they came up with other things which could be, in a way, regarded as principles for good life, that by and large are not part of our cultural conversation anymore.
Does it square with do no harm?
That's a if you're a doctor, good point, isn't it?
You know,
first do
you have
no
to redefine
harm.
That maybe.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Natalie, Rupert Murdoch set to face his kids in court with Fox News' fate in the balance. Is that such a big deal? They're just a mainstream outlet in the end, aren't they? Dying dinosaur. But the empire's massive and the kids. And there are multiple generations of children to different mothers too, right? It's quite complicated.
Yeah, well, I think it just, you know, that story really is just a conversation starter for the interrelated nature of the four M's, the music industry, movies, media, and money. And most people know by now how influenced the media is and the interaction, you know, the interrelated impact of the government and the media. I mean, we've learned this the hard way over the past 4 years. So I think that story is kind of interesting, but it just goes to show you how Rupert Murdoch and his empire have shaped a lot of this culture and society because of his influence and fingers in many pies in various media outlets, and then the messages that come through movies and the social normalization of things that flow on from things that we watch as we're just basically being told what to think, who to like, and how to live our lives quite often.
It's how most people are programmed, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now?
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So they watch something and they, I mean, even the Trump thing, if we want to go there, so many people, like I work with the elderly and we were doing this acrostic word puzzle and you had to think of a word that started with T and ended in P. And some of them were like tarp or whatever. And someone said Trump and half the room starts booing. But I mean, hey, I didn't get into a political conversation with them, but whenever someone starts booing Trump, I'm like, yeah, but you're only doing that because you basically have been told that he's bad and he's wrong. We don't realize how often we're told what to think.
Yeah, that you can see how baying crowds come together, right?
Yes. And they feed off each other's energy and opinions. But no one wants to look, you know, a lot of humanity, people don't want to look bad. They don't want to be seen to be doing the wrong thing, which is why so many people queued up to do what they were told and quote unquote do the right thing. So it's concerning.
You're absolutely right. And of course, we're seeing a great insight into the music industry with this Diddy thing, mm-hmm. with these horrific parties. And, you know, we know the same thing will be going on in Hollywood. And when you're a kid, when you're a young teenager, you listen to those songs, those pop songs, over and over and over again, completely oblivious almost to the message that they're giving.
Yeah.
But of course, it's burying into your brain. I'm very proud to report, and you'll love this, Jan, that my 13-year-old daughter, to my horror, loved Taylor Swift. And she and I would argue in the car because she'd want to be listening to Taylor Swift. And my wife played for her the great Megyn Kelly put down that she did of Taylor Swift when she came out in support of Kamala Harris, and how Taylor Swift is supporting the death cult of the trans movement and having these kids mutilated. My daughter, from that moment on, will not listen to Taylor Swift.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
I heard a really interesting piece from Neil Oliver just last day or so, and he was talking about a book he'd read. I'm going to look it up, about Laurel Canyon out of Los Angeles, Southern California, where all the musos lived, Crosby, Stills, yes. and Nash,
yes.
Joni Mitchell, who else? Frank Zappa. I mean, Jim Morrison, even Charlie Manson, all in there. And the connection was all of them were related to the military. Jim Morrison's father commanded the naval fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin. Frank Zappa's father was a high-up official in the Air Force. Charlie Manson auditioned for the Monkees and nearly got in. There's this sort of weird connection with everyone. You remember Buffalo Springfield, Stephen Stills, something's happening here, what it is, isn't clear, whatever. So how long has the music industry in this case been part of messaging of some sort? It's crazy.
The entire time.
Yeah.
And of course, modern art, you know, and you realize, you know, that this modern art is also an assault on our ability to think clearly and to reason, you know, where you put the most absurd thing and you're supposed to admire it greatly, and you're looking at it and you're thinking a 5-year-old could draw that, and you realize,
I know what you mean.
You realize that someone only needs to go along and buy a piece like that for $500,000 or bid it up to $500,000, and then that artist becomes famous, and people are looking at it like it's special. And I think the same thing happens to musicians, because there's thousands of very good singers. There's thousands of very good songwriters, but only a few get through. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what do they have to do to get through?
I think that's the key question.
I do think with the P. Diddy thing, it's going to be a bit of a slow reveal of who else is involved. And I think it is time for the untouchables to come tumbling down off the pedestal. I think it's time for us to stop worshiping and these, you know, the musicians and the actors. I think I'm hoping that we're going to see some big revelations in that area in the next, I'm going to say in the next 30 days.
Do you That's think you'd sing like a bird or get horizontally hung like Epstein?
The former.
I can take a slightly different tack, and it's that our media, the centralization of the control of our media, not so much in New Zealand now, interestingly, but overseas with the Murdoch Empire, is paralleled by the centralization of the control of our social media platforms. So Facebook and Twitter and the others and Google. And it strikes me that we're in a very kind of weird situation where court cases are happening between state governments and, for example, Twitter, where or Facebook, where the decisions of one person are having an influence on the availability or the lack of availability of information across our media, across our ability to gather information. And that has to be unhealthy.
Yes.
But the other aspect of that is that here in New Zealand, we hear often that there are constraints on social media. Like, for example, we heard a few weeks ago that Brazil had banned Twitter. We never got the news that that court case was unsuccessful and Twitter is back, or X is back, available in Brazil at the moment. So I'm not the world's best observer, but I did read an article recently that showed a lot of the ability of states to constrain the passage, the use, the availability of information, are failing in the face of legal cases trying to stop that. So there's a kind of, and I don't know whether these state governments are going to increase their powers and their ability to deal with what I regard as so-called, often so-called misinformation. Obviously, there is malevolent information and there is information manipulation. But there's an interesting battle going on at the moment, but it's all to do with centralization of power.
There's always been mis and disinformation, if you want to think of, I don't know what the previous descriptions would be. Yeah. I mean, so what?
That's not the point, Paul. The point is that you can actually have someone in Google just even altering an algorithm and completely changing the perception of the entire world about an issue, because what gets pushed or what doesn't get pushed changes people's view, and they think they're reading, you know, an unbiased account. You can have people being deplatformed on X or Twitter, or pushed down on X and Twitter, and it's extraordinary, this great force for goodness and connecting people and allowing us to access the world's knowledge has become malevolent through the claim of misinformation and malinformation, and the ability of actors to say we need to take control of this and direct people. I think that's Jan's point.
Absolutely. I mean, the way that algorithms, I think one of the problems is that the ability of governments to legislate for open information largely is, exactly as Rodney says, related to the way that the algorithms work in order to fuel our disbelief, our horror, our kind of, you know, we're constantly pushed towards the margins rather than being rational information seekers. And that's all to do with the marketing drive of social media platforms. You know, they earn the dollar based on our attention and our eyeballs. Mm. And that's where the market, rather than good governance, has been allowed to prosper and flourish, in my view.
People need to be discerning, though, don't they, Natalie? They need to be discerning. And if they can't be, well, it's not my problem.
Well, we all do. I mean, it's we're fed so much stuff. And like you say, the algorithms, they serve it up. And then we suddenly think, oh, I've always thought like this. But no, we're just absorbing like sponges. I think we all need to be discerning. It's an ongoing challenge.
I think it's a deeper issue. It's a much deeper issue. I don't know about anyone else, but I used to love the internet. And now I find it vacuous. And what's happened, of course, is that AI has taken it over, and there's all these fake web pages, and you can never actually find useful information. And likewise, I loved Google when it first came. It was amazing. You could search up the most incredible things. But I can hardly find anything now using Google. Even searches that I used to do 5 or 10 years ago that would yield a gold mine. And I think the internet has just become extremely rubbishy, much to my disappointment. There's other people noticing that.
Maybe. Mm.
I used to go to the conferences of Internet New Zealand, and there was an absolute divide in the conferences that took place before and after the Edward Snowden revelations. And up until that point, there was an enormous idealism, which I must admit I shared in, which was about the democratization of information and people being well informed and, you know, the ability of very niche groups of people with a particular issue being able to get together and discuss that issue. And I've started to think now that the internet and with the combination of the internet and artificial intelligence, it's actually become a black hole for information. We're almost entering a kind of new dark ages where we can't trust what we see.
Or Tower of Babel.
Yeah. And unless we know a journalist that we've trusted for a period of time, and we read them because we trust their insights, we're really at a loss. And I think that's one of the things that sits behind the diminution of trust in the media. And if we don't have a media, if we don't find a way of funding a fair and relevant media, then we're potentially heading into a very dark place. I always thought when Stuff owned Trade Me that they had the mix completely right. I think they had a vehicle for creating revenue, and then they could put that revenue towards providing good quality journalism. That's not how it worked out. But to me, that's the obvious way, which is that the people who benefit from the revenue from advertising should in some way help to provide good quality media. It's a problem that's eminently solvable, but governments have for whatever reason not really grasped the metal. They've done something in Australia, I think, around charging social media outlets, or making social media outlets contribute to the journalism that they publish. But there's been a big fight back on the behalf of the social media companies about doing that.
Rodney, you have to go in a moment, don't you? You're on a tight time.
Yes, I do. But I'm actually, I'm okay now for a few more minutes.
Oh, good. All right. Well, I was just thinking, as we're talking about algorithms and being discerning and what do you trust, same goes for politics. Can't believe anything anyone says anymore. Purveyors of massive dis, mis, and malinformation. Everything's soundbited, everything's focus grouped. So it's everywhere, even there. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep. Okay.
All right. Moving on. Police Commissioner Andrew Costa resigns, as Lindsay Perigo said, only to get into a new plum job as head of a new social investment agency. Don't know about you, but I have no time for this man at all. Anyone else got to say something about this?
Oh, I've looked to belatedly, obviously, in some ways, at his biography. And he seems to have had an absolutely stellar career in the police. And he was for a while seconded to the Ministry of Justice to run their project around modernising the courts. He's been an assistant commissioner and then a deputy commissioner before being appointed the commissioner. He's the youngest person ever to have held the role. So, you know, he was 44 when he was appointed to that role, I think.
Commissioner? 44 to the police commissioner job, he's 44. Too young. Yeah. Way too young.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, he's obviously been incredibly successful. He's been involved also in, he was responsible for the firearms arrangements in the aftermath of the Christchurch massacre. And he also was the deputy chief executive of the Ministry of Justice while he was there. And I think it seems to me that he was fast-tracked through the police. He's from a family where his father was a professor, so he's not just.
Oh dear, it's getting worse all the time. It's just going downhill all the time.
How do you mean going downhill? Sorry.
Well, you know, professor. You know, I got no respect for experts anymore. Academia. Most of them are morons in my mind now. I mean, they might have nice paper qualifications, but they don't seem very smart to me, so that's not impressive. And look what he did to the protesters on the lawn of Parliament. He ordered that.
I thought that he was less than keen to have a...
I don't care. He should have resigned.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm with you, Paul. I think he's been... another failed commissioner. They're very, very political. They're very, very unctuous. He's actually been pushed out of the role early, clearly, and they found him a nice parachute that he'd go to because it's impossible to get rid of a commissioner. Only the Governor General could sack them. But this guy, to me, has been an abject failure for all the reasons, funny enough, that Jan elucidated. The firearm stuff, the way the police came after private owners of firearms after the mosque attack, when actually it was their complete failure to administer our existing firearms law that saw this guy armed, was truly, truly a problem for me. The treatment of the protesters was absolutely disgusting. The failure to protect Posy Parker and the ladies that were gathered at Albert Park,
that's right.
That's directly on him. And the fact that he has the police parading around showing their rainbow tick proudly, rather than protecting citizens that pay their way, truly disgusts me. This is a guy who's completely lost his way in what the role of commissioner and what the role of the police are in society. And we're so much the poorer because of his administration. And I'm afraid it's not going to be reversed because we'll appoint another pillar. There, I think I've said my piece.
Natalie, anything to say?
Well, just echoing that. I mean, we haven't seen any acknowledgement, any apology, or any accountability in terms of that treatment that Rodney highlighted. So, yeah, he's just been moved aside. But well, I guess we'll just watch this space and see what happens.
Yeah. But going through the CV like you did there before, Jan, sounds like he's been the perfect guy for certain things, right? Certain things.
I think so. That
probably for doing what he's told, I imagine.
No, that's what I'm alluding to.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, on the other hand, and as Rodney has mentioned, his adoption, like many public sector chief executives of the diversity, inclusion and equity, was first class, by which I mean it ended up with a part of the police being trained to be told that they must record hate incidents, and hate was defined as in the eye of the beholder, you know, which is clearly insane. And one of the things that Mark Mitchell did when he became the police minister was to have a letter of expectation with the police commissioner, which obviously I suspect was not agreeable to the police commissioner and has ultimately ended up with him leaving early. But the Free Speech Union was very active in protesting the kind of training that was happening within the police around regarding as hate speech, things which were manifestly not hate speech at all. And interestingly, I've got a I got a really good, I wrote to complain about that to the minister, and like all of the other people who did, got a reasonably reassuring response to say that our feedback had been received and the material in the training will be reviewed and amended to ensure that it's appropriately framed to the law and the police's responsibilities. So I think that it was quite a big pullback on obviously what was happening, which was very much overkill. There was.
Why
no
did they ever say sorry? We were wrong. Sorry. They never say that, do they?
Not. No. It's interesting that has, I don't think even the minister has made that statement publicly about the way that he has constrained the police from recording information or being trained in a way that clearly was illegal, not legal.
Yeah. All right. The end of working from home, Natalie.
Well, not the end, hopefully.
well, for government employees anyway.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. More government control and crackdown, I think. I think people had a bit of taste of freedom and flexibility over the past 4 years. I've worked for myself for 12, 15 years. I can't imagine having a 9-to-5 job, but for those that do, I don't even think it's actually very healthy, but more on that later. But I think a lot of people have had a taste of being their own boss to a certain extent. And I think it's tragic if the government's going to come in and tell them all to get back to the office. I think getting back to the office, there is a camaraderie and a connection, of course, of meeting in person rather than Zoom. I'm all for that. But I think there is a fine line, and taking people's, and, you know, different people have different, what works best for them. You know, some people work really well in a stimulating office environment. For others, that's actually not very good for their health. It's, it can be quite draining, quite exhausting, and a lot of people interrupting them. So I think it's just another sign of the government trying to be more controlling of people.
One of the things that I had the experience of having been in the public sector with one of those 9-to-5 jobs is that the layout of most of the Wellington's government offices is that they are appalling places to work. A lot of them are nothing more than cube farms. They have no room dividers. The areas set aside for meetings are very small. Mm. You can hear half a dozen conversations going on between other people in many parts of government. They've actually not provided enough desks for each person. And so you arrive in the morning not knowing whether you're going to sit with your team. You have nothing but you have to gather up everything off your desk at the end of the day and stick it into a hole in the wall that you then lock. So the whole... It just seems to me to be a very kind of alienating environment. It's like you're being warehoused in an office rather than actually working there with colleagues. So I think that has made the public sector much less effective. I mean, if we're talking about public servants and flexible working. And the other thing that's made the public sector less efficient has been two things. One of them is that every time a new chief executive is appointed, it seems to me to be the personality and the preferences of that chief executive that determine so much about the way that the department is run, when actually that's entirely inappropriate. The government departments are there to implement legislation and policy, not to be driven by the personality and preferences of the chief executive. The second thing is constant reorganization. And that's happening at the moment, of course, as the public sector is retrenching, that everybody is not doing their job. They're fighting for the continuity of their role. And there must be tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars every year wasted in both of those approaches to managing, or the approaches I've just defined to managing the public sector. The way the offices are run, the chief executives, and the reorganisations.
Saving that money could have bought new ferries, maybe.
Could have, indeed.
Anyway, Rodney's popped off. He's had to go. We're at the end of our political panel. Thank you, Natalie, for coming in.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
And Jan Rivers from GenSpec, thank you. And do you want to tell us quickly, right at the end here, about the conference taking place in Lisbon, right, this weekend?
Two things very quickly. Yeah, GenSpec is having its annual conference in Lisbon this weekend. And it has, for the last 3 years, this is the third year, followed the conferences of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, the discredited activist organisation. And the other really good bit of news that's come out today is that the people who have for a long time known that we are prescribing puberty blockers at many times the rate of the rest of the world, and possibly the highest in the world, have finally had their paper published, I think, today in the New Zealand Medical Journal. Very much hoping that that gets some coverage.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting us know about that. And thank you for coming on. And we'll do it all again in a week. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.